At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
I first started running about 15 years ago as a way to quit smoking. Back then, my running clothes were very Rocky Balboa. So sweatpants, sweatshirt. Anyone who goes hiking or trail running knows that it's a lot easier and a lot more fun when you're wearing the right gear. Jonji makes performance apparel that'll take you farther on your runs and hikes. They have this merino wool hoodie that I wore on multiple trail runs this weekend. It's soft, it's warm, and most importantly, it does not get stinky when you get stinky. Another reason to love Jonji is that they donate 2% of all sales towards clean water projects, raising nearly $1 million so far. Head to jonji.com to find your new favorite trail wear, outdoors accessories, and essentials. And use the code OUTSIDE for 10% off at jonji.com. That's JANJI.com with the code OUTSIDE for 10% off. When I was a little kid, my whole family, grandparents included, packed into a Dodge Caravan and went on a 2-week road trip to Wyoming. We saw the rodeo in Cody, a grizzly bear in Yellowstone National Park, and an epic thunderstorm near Devil's Tower. On that trip, I fell in love with the West and the natural world. This might sound cheesy, but it kind of made me who I am today. Wyoming has it all. Breathtaking hikes, kid-friendly museums, two of the coolest national parks in the country. The truth lies west. Discover yours at travelwyoming.com.
This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Since the first protests on May 26th, millions of people across America and across the world have taken to the streets to express their grief and anger and demand justice for the killing of George Floyd by Minnesota law enforcement.
We've been fired at with rubber bullets. My cameraman has been hit. We've also seen tear gas being used. Here we go, they're moving through again.
But that's not the outdoors community, right? The outdoors is for everyone. Naturalists are so welcoming. Well, it might seem like 100 years ago now, but just before the very first protest began, another racist incident was already sparking outrage online.
So there's an incident in New York Central Park caught on camera, and it's going viral.
Christian Cooper, a black man who had been birdwatching in New York City for decades, was in the Ramble, 36 acres of semi-forested woodland in Central Park, when he asked a nearby woman to obey the park rules and leash her dog. She refused, and before the confrontation ended, the woman called the police while Christian recorded her with his smartphone.
Amy Cooper has apologized but was fired from her job. Join me now as Christian.
We say Outside In's a show about the natural world and how we use it, but the history of these spaces will show that white gatekeepers have long held a great deal of power in deciding who gets access to the natural world and how. And it points to how the experience of public outdoor spaces isn't the same for everyone. Brenton Mock wrote in an article for CityLab that peaceful, green spaces just as easily induce anxiety and trauma for black and brown people, especially when they know the cops can be unleashed at any moment. But this particular incident has also inspired what you might call a celebratory response. It's called hashtag Black Birders Week. And from May 31st to June 5th, the initiative shared pictures, stories, and held online events that highlighted black voices, while at the same time examining how outdoor spaces can be implicitly or explicitly threatening and dangerous to people of color. Danielle Bellany is a wildlife biologist and one of the core organizers behind Black Birders Week. Danielle, thank you so much for being with me.
Oh, I'm excited to be here.
I kind of want to just start with a little real talk. So, like, if there are listeners out there who are rolling their eyes and saying, like, do we need to bring race into birding too? Like, can we just bat that aside? Like, what are the types of experiences that you've had with white birders?
Yeah, so, I mean, the fact that people think that racism doesn't happen in the birding community is pretty, I mean, it's laughable to me. Racism is going to happen anywhere where I am. It's because I'm black that racism happens to me. So I've been followed around by people that are on trails because I think I look suspicious with my binoculars while I'm staring at bushes or like trees and stuff. Or I've also had the cops called on me while I've been working. And it's really frightening when those situations happen. It's just like, I'm just trying to do my job. I'm trying to like be out here and enjoying in nature just like the rest of us.
Can you just tell me a little bit about yourself, like your relationship with the natural world, how you got excited about it, what it means to you?
Sure. So I am from San Antonio, Texas. I was definitely a very outdoorsy kid growing up. I would pick up the bugs from the lawn. I would pick up snakes too, like as like a 5-4-year-old. Definitely fearless from the jump of it. I did not know that wildlife biology was something you could actually pursue as a job. I thought you could only be like a zoo keeper or like a veterinarian to work with animals. But no, it turns out there's so many other opportunities. And what got me really into research and really into birds was this internship I had doing nest searching in South Texas. And I basically got to watch baby birds grow up the whole summer. And it was really, really, really cool to see how a bird turns from an egg to a full bird in like a couple of days. It's an unbelievable process. And I've been watching this black-throated hummingbird nest in my backyard, my first ever hummingbird nest that I found. They just left the nest yesterday, and I'm so happy to be able to watch that whole process happen. It's just magical.
I love it. We have Phoebes that nest under the porch every year. And the great thing about them being under the porch is you can look between the cracks of the boards and like peek at them like really, really close, like a couple inches above the nest. It's so fun.
Cute.
I know. So how did it come together? Because I have to confess, I saw the hashtag, I saw a bunch of, you know, my feed was sort of full of it. But then it wasn't until I clicked on the organizers list and saw how many co-organizers there are that I realized this is really something that, you know, it seems like it came together very quickly, but a lot of enthusiasm from a lot of different quarters.
Oh, absolutely. So immediately after the incident, you know, the Black STEM group that I'm in, we have a group chat and we were just, you know, just chatting. It's usually there just for us to hang out and like have a space to be together. But when this incident happened, we were like, oh, we have to say something about this. So a couple of us just had some independent tweets. But then back in the group, Anna Gifty Opuku Agayeman, she is an economist with no background in birds or wildlife sciences. She was like, you guys could actually make a thing out of this. Like, this can get some attention. And within 2 days, we had Blackbirders Week organized. We had all kinds of things, you know, lined up. And I think the excitement to put our voices out there and to also just create a community with Black outdoor enthusiasts helped us and pushed us to go all those sleepless hours to create this event in 2 days. It's amazing.
Yeah. And it seems like you've had a lot of interest because, you know, I just heard someone being interviewed on 1A earlier on NPR for the full hour. And we had like, I think 5 listeners email us and say that we should do something about it. And it's just been everywhere.
My jaw is dropping right now. That's so cool.
So what were the goals? Like, what did you want to accomplish with this?
First off, to uplift and recognize that Black birders and Black outdoor enthusiasts exist. Oftentimes, you know, especially a hobby like birding is considered like, oh, that's an old white guy kind of activity. Like, oh, that's pretty boring. Like, why would you do that? We wanted to provide reassurance through community by reaching out and letting other people that are maybe isolated in their interest know that no, you have friends. We are here. Come join us, even though it's online. We definitely have a community. We also want our non-Black peers to, you know, understand the experiences that Black birders and Black outdoor enthusiasts have, that we're often uncomfortable and unwelcome in these spaces. And we're really just out there trying to find a release, trying to get rid of the stressors that, you know, Black people have on their lives. We are responding to the incident with Christian Cooper and Amy Cooper, but this is also about the murders of other Black lives like Breonna Taylor, Monica Diamond, Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, so many other Black lives being lost because of white supremacy and because of racism.
We on the show have done one birding episode a while ago. I interviewed a guy who was like who at the time had the big year record. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like have an entree into birder culture with like the listers and the twitchers and like the people who are very sort of, it's almost like a sport. I guess I'm wondering is how welcoming this sort of like quirky, insular, sometimes birding community has been to black birders. Not just the stories of people seeing you with suspicion when you're out there with binoculars, but how actual other white birders react when there's suddenly someone who doesn't look like them in their group.
Right. So for the Twitchers, I just learned that word last night. So that's eye opening to me. Like, oh, y'all get called that? Okay, cool. I'll stick with birders. but I think birders in general just want more birders, birders to be birding, want more people to have interest in birds. Because once you like slide somebody into like one little niche interest, they eventually understand like a grander scale of how conservation is really, really important. And you can do that by studying birds and being interested in birds and sending money to bird organizations. I think birders as a whole are very inviting. However, again, you know, once you get inside the group, you do start to realize, oh, you know, yeah, this is the same racism that I experienced when I'm, you know, at school or some other activity. The racism is still the same, but I think the welcomingness of birders and how they're so interested in birding definitely draws people in.
I had seen you tweet that sometimes you feel like you're getting quizzed, like are you really a birder? And they'll like ask you extra questions about like making sure that you're properly IDing birds that, you know, can make you feel like a little bit of an outsider.
Yeah, and that happened less than, I think, like 2 weeks ago. I was out in San Antonio out birding because I just needed to go out. This group of white birders were looking in a bush, and I was like, oh, they seem really excited. Maybe there's something interesting over there. So I walk up to the group and like, hey, what are y'all looking at? They turn around and look at me. They don't say anything, turn back around, start looking at the bird again. I'm like, okay, maybe they didn't hear me, even though I'm a respectable socially distance away from them. But I'm like, okay, let me just ask them one more time. And they turn around. This time they actually like acknowledge me, and they're like, oh, it's a gray cat bird. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And I'm here in like my bird hat and like my bird scarf and like my bird shirt. Like I'm fully nerded out in bird gear. Right. And I think
it's like, how else could I be signaling to you that
honestly,
I belong?
My binoculars are on my chest. I've been like with my eBird app. Like I look like such a dork right now. Like let me be a dork with y'all. But I mean, I also don't care about the projections of white birders and what they think of me. I'm going to do what I do because I love it. And I don't need their validation to do that.
What would you recommend for black people who are listening, who are interested in doing things like bird watching, but maybe feel hesitant because it is seen as such a white hobby and they need a little inspiration?
Do you? I mean, you can go out birding without binoculars. As long as you have an interest and a passion, that's really all you need. Also, you know, find us online at Black AF and STEM. We want to hear your voices. We want to connect with you. Like, that's why we are here.
And then... Also, any recommendations for white people who are listening and, you know, ways that they could be better in terms of being welcoming and being allies?
Sure. Yeah. I would say speak up when you hear something that is racist. Like, we need our allies to be actively anti-racist. And also donate. I mean, if you can donate to a local black organization, a black nature organization or something, to help other black kids get access to these wonderful things that are outside, paving the way for more diversity. If we understand like the importance of ecological diversity in a system, the fact that we have so many connections through so many species and it makes a more resilient community, we can do that same thing through diversity in our spaces. It'll make a more stronger and more resilient community in the same sense.
Officially, Black Birders Week is over, but obviously the importance of this isn't going anywhere. So I guess what's next?
Yeah. Yes, Black Birders Week is ending soon, but I mean, Black Birders Week is forever. Like, we're going to be out here, like, every day. Black AF and STEM, we are a very biology, wildlife science heavy group, but we need to highlight more Black voices in all STEM topics. So come over and join our group so you can get highlighted in whatever really cool, interesting thing in STEM that you do. But yeah, we're going to keep doing this. This is not where we're going to stop. Next year, yeah. Black Birders Week is going to be even more poppin'.
Yeah, every week is Black Birders Week. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Danielle Bellany is a wildlife biologist and one of the co-organizers behind Black Birders Week. Search the hashtag on Twitter to see some of the incredible posts the week inspired. And you can follow at BlackAFInSTEM to keep tabs on what's next. There were so many amazing, inspirational, and sometimes heartbreaking stories that were shared as part of Black Birders Week. So Danielle and her co-organizers asked you to share some of them with us via voicemail.
I am a veteran and a woman of color, and I found herpetology and wildlife biology on my quest to become a veterinarian. And on that quest, I have met and had some very interesting things said to me from people feeling like, you know, they had to say something like, you know, what's up, my sister, instead of just saying hello, or, you know, I have to dab it instead of just shaking hands. And I had one lady one time, we were on a prescribed burn, and she asked me, aren't you afraid all that hair is going to get caught on fire? She said it right in front of the union rep. No one said anything. So about a year ago, my supervisor found out that I was using my platform as a way to outreach to minority children about wildlife biology and public land and land management, or whatever it was I could get out there. He was so, you know, hateful or, you know, discouraging with his no. It's made staying in wildlife biology very hard to deal with. It has made being a birder difficult, being a herpetologist difficult. I just took all that in over the last year or so, and I didn't post anything. I stopped. I was discouraged, and I allowed myself to get discouraged and oppressed. And then one of the girls I follow on Instagram, who is also a herpetologist, started sharing about this hashtag in this page, and I said, let me see what this is about. With all the things that are going on, like, I could see some people who look like me. I could use some people who, you know, talk like me and have the same interests as me. And after more than a year of not posting, I decided that the best way to fight back with all that hate was love. Love for what I do, love for sharing it on social media, love for sharing it with my family and friends. This page and this week and these posts have showed me, like, we're out here. I've never been so proud and so inspired and so motivated. I am so happy.
This is Day Scott, recording from Lander, Wyoming. The last week has been one of the most difficult weeks in my life.
I am recovering from a traumatic brain injury. So anything in addition to that that happens just puts me in a very challenging place emotionally.
At a point last week, I didn't even know how to move forward in life. Like, I was in this moment and I did not know what was going to happen the second moment. It's already hard enough for me right now. I was just thinking, like, well, what next? How much more can I take? I didn't really hear from anybody in my community. And then I got on social media, and so many people were just condemning looters and using all sorts of unkind language. It was just very unpleasant to read what they thought was most important. I kept wondering if they even thought about me when they looked at these incidents and murders that were just happening over the last few weeks. This is the same community that came together when I had a brain injury or when I had my car accident. And they came together and took care of me. For me not to see them speak up or even check on me to say, oh, how are you doing? Text me, call me. Like, we live so close together. It was really an eye-opener. As a Black person in Wyoming, I don't walk around at night. I don't know. It just does not feel comfortable for me to do that. When I'm out birding, I always make sure that my equipment can be seen. Along with my, right now, wearing a Cotopaxi backpack. It's really bright and colorful. I want people to see me. I want people to know that, oh, that's just Day. We know her. Because I don't want any incidents. I am here by myself as a Black woman in a small town in Wyoming. When I heard about Black Birders Week, I was able to channel some of the fear, anger, and sadness into hope, awareness, and comfort. I found my voice. I found a lane that I could be in, as I cannot really attend any events with crowds due to my brain injury. Black Birders Week simply made me feel like I belong. Though it was through a virtual community, it created a voice that had been silenced due to fear. It opened the joy of sharing my gift and allowing others to experience nature through my eyes.
Those stories came to us from contributors to Black Birders Week. Thanks to everyone who sent us a story, but for whom we didn't have time. You can still send us your stories by recording one on your smartphone and sending it to outsidein@nhpr.org. Coming up, the Urban Heat Island Effect meets our American history of redlining. Stick around.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Save big money on everything for your spring projects at Menards. We have all of your garden and landscaping essentials. Master Garden Premium Garden Soil contains a slow-release fertilizer that feeds gardens for up to 9 months. It produces better results and is ready to use for all your gardening needs. Save big on Menards' great selection of garden and landscaping products. Compare brands in-store or online at Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
This is Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. As protests against police violence have swelled, so too have temperatures been climbing into one of the first serious heat spells of the year. Here's a clip from Tucson, Arizona's local news affiliate, KUGN9.
It was over 100 degrees out, but people didn't seem to let that bother them. Among the protesters was Zach Bukarski, a recent University of Arizona grad from Chicago.
Heat is not a factor. This is about more than just uncomfortable because the people who are getting oppressed by the
To some, the temperatures may seem divorced from the issues being protested, but a lot of connections can be made between high temperatures and demands for racial justice by Black Americans. Severe heat is the deadliest form of extreme weather in the United States, and because of the design of urban
urban spaces, and the country's history of discriminatory housing policies, Black Americans and other marginalized communities are affected in disproportionate numbers. To learn more, producer Taylor Quimby spoke with Rachel Ramirez, an environmental justice reporter at Grist, where you'll find her article, Another Legacy of Redlining, Unequal Exposure to Heat Waves.
Rachel, can you just start with just an overview of what is the urban heat island effect?
Right. So like climate change, the urban heat island effect is made by humans. So several researchers and even the Environmental Protection Agency have said that extreme heat kills more Americans each year than any other hazardous climate-related event. So the urban heat island effect, which makes extreme heat in cities even worse than it already is, happens because of traditional urban design choices. So tall buildings, dark roofs, black pavement cause the air to stagnate, and they all attract and absorb sun rays. So that cities like New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles are way hotter than, say, a suburb that's just a few miles away from that city. And people of color are more likely to live in urban heat islands than white people. As a result, they face more health risks during a heat wave.
I mean, is it measurably stronger or weaker, even within a large city? You know, parts of the city are, on average, have higher temps?
The answer is yes. New York City, for example, is a heat island. But even heat islands can have hot spots. So neighborhoods like Hunts Point in the South Bronx or Sunset Park in Brooklyn, they heat up even more than the overall city. So the neighborhoods we call fence line communities, so quote unquote fence line communities where residents live alongside industrial facilities like peaker plants or power plants, they tend to have fewer trees or green spaces that help cool an area down. These things like exacerbate the already hot heat conditions that typically low-income communities of color already face. And the South Bronx, especially, is called Asthma Alley. That area has the city's highest rate of emergency care visits for asthma, as well as respiratory hospitalizations. It also has among the neighborhoods hardest hit by COVID-19. And, you know, there's a Harvard study that already links air pollution to higher COVID-19 outcomes.
Right. And you know, what we've been hearing is a really staggering degree to which COVID-19 is affecting people of color disproportionately as well.
Right. Yeah. Right.
When you're thinking about, you mentioned green spaces, you know, urban design in those places. I mean, we know how connected those are to wealth, to race. Can you talk a little bit about the connection between urban design and urban planning and the history of housing developments and some of the other ways that people have been placed really in some of these neighborhoods that are most at risk?
Early this year, I wrote a story on how some of the legacies of redlining, which, as most of us know, is the government-sanctioned denial of home loans and insurance to communities of color, particularly Black households, is a strong predictor of which neighborhoods are essentially disproportionately exposed to extreme heat. In other cases, although redlining was banned in the late 1960s, we still see some of its legacies. So predominantly Black neighborhoods are pushed out near a fossil fuel industry or below sea level neighborhoods in Louisiana. So it's not just heat. And one of the things the researchers have told me is that our zip codes are a strong predictor of our health because it shows what we're exposed to. And as I've written before, like so many aspects of the climate crisis, heat doesn't affect all people equally. Marginalized low-income communities of color, they bear the brunt of these extreme weather events. And in some cases, these are neighborhoods with barely any green space to cool the residents down as a result of redlining. These places are drastically hotter than their surrounding suburbs and rural areas. And I'm actually working on a story right now on urban green spaces and kind of asking the question on who has access to those spaces and kind of exploring this idea of of urban green displacement or urban green gentrification.
You mean like where parks get located and who's actually right. able to like get to them either by foot or by transport?
Right. Like it's kind of a case study of New York City's High Line, right? So Chelsea neighborhood used to be a predominantly Black neighborhood or Hispanic neighborhood. And when the High Line came up, it kind of displaced a lot of the communities of color there. They were kind of priced out of that neighborhood. And so kind of exploring the historical aspects of that.
I mean, does it strike you that so many of these protests over George Floyd and over, racial injustice are happening in these streets that are designed in this way?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we've been kind of reporting at GRIS is that environmental injustice is racial injustice. And one of my colleagues, Navina, actually wrote about how some of the state lawmakers have introduced bills that either made, obstructing traffic on highways a crime or, has increased penalties for protesting near an oil and gas facility. And some of these proposals were introduced in response to ongoing protests against controversial oil pipelines. And that's also including or following, the police killing of Philando Castile. I also wrote about St. James Parish in Louisiana, mm-hmm. which is a really good case. In the middle of the pandemic, the LDEQ, the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality, approved permits for this gigantic petrochemical facility to set up shop in St. James in the middle of the pandemic when the Harvard study came out of connecting air pollution and severe COVID-19 outcomes. And I don't know if you saw news, but that petrochemical facility would set up shop on top of two former sugarcane plantation sites and also part of a slave burial ground. So it's kind of like this threat multiplier for African Americans, and these companies are setting up shop in these communities because they think that they wouldn't fight back or they don't have the capacity to know what's going on.
Studying and reporting on these issues, I mean, do you see divisions among climate activists about how much emphasis to put on environmental justice when it comes to, the strategy of climate change? I know I've seen in some recent months at least a couple of high-profile writers who are basically getting trolled by followers who want the issues to be separate and dislike when environmental justice is at the fore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First of all, I think a lot of times people don't really understand that the environmental justice beat. For instance, last week, in the midst of all the protests, one journalist asked something along the lines of on Twitter, does the media industry need more journalists whose beats focus on criminal justice? And like, if not, which beats do you wish existed in newsrooms? And, I live on Twitter, so I replied, environmental justice. And the response was something like, that's right, we can't report if we end up killing the planet or something like that, which is true, but not entirely the point that I was trying to make, because environmental justice disproportionately kills Black people because, of the air they breathe from nearby fossil fuel facilities. And from my reporting, oil and gas companies choose to set up shop in neighborhoods of color, as I mentioned, because they have this notion that they could get away with air permit violations because they think the residents don't know anything. Well, the reality is they do, because these communities are noticing a trend and many of them are fighting back. And yes, I do think there's a divide among climate activists, because environmental justice is one of those things that's so complex where people think climate change is just about saving the planet or more extreme weather events. But when it comes to communities, we have to look deeper into, the corporations in power or government officials working to regulate these violations and that are affecting the climate and also the health of communities of color.
Hmm. Do you see, you mentioned, this Twitter post that's happening right now. Do you think that the protests that are taking place in this moment are changing the narrative in terms of climate activism and environmental justice?
Yeah, I think it's also hard to say, but there is a narrative change right now. In part, I'm thinking thanks to all the young people. Last year, 2019, was sort of a momentous year for the climate movement, especially led by the youth. I was at the UN General Assembly last September and met many of the youth activists from around the world. And I think it's incredible that, you know, they see more deeply into these situations more clearly than the older generation. You know, they're worried about their future, and rightfully so. And it's brave of them to take on corporations like Exxon, BP, Chevron, and whatnot. You know, I think they have changed the narrative, and they've pushed the needle and moved forward the climate conversation.
Any recommended reading before I let you go for listeners who just want to know more about the connections between race, housing, climate, all the stuff that we've been talking about?
Right. You know, there's a ton of books and resources out there in which, you know, you could sort of get a sense of the intersection between environmental justice and housing segregation and race. And one of my favorite actually is The 1619 Project by Nicole Hannah-Jones, mm-hmm. whose work, you know, I love so much. Highlights a few of those intersections, starting from the plantation farms. There's also this book that my colleague Yvette Cabrera recommended to me called Moving Toward Integration, the Past and Future of Fair Housing, which discusses migration from rural to urban areas in the South, including the great migration to cities like Detroit and Chicago. And I think lastly, I highly encourage reading the work that we do at GRIS, since we do work really hard to write about the intersection of race and climate justice.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for the recommendations, and thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Taylor.
That was Rachel Ramirez, an environmental justice fellow at GRIST, speaking with producer Taylor Quimby. This episode was produced by Taylor Quimby, me, Sam Evans-Brown, Justine Paradise, and Felix Poon. It originally aired on NHPR on June 6th. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is the director of content, which is her actual job title, by the way. Special thanks to the organizers and participants from Black Birders Week for sharing their stories. Music in this episode from Jazzar, Blue Dot Sessions, Ash Turner, Broke for Free, and Ikimashu Aoi. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Remember that we have a newsletter that you might like to get. We share interesting links, good reading, and occasionally pictures of us goofing off behind the scenes. You can sign up at outsideinradio.org. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
Vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.